616, get in the mix, stir the batter. Constant chatter on CKUT 90.3 FM. Did I miss something?
Issues that are discussed and others that are either accidentally or deliberately left out. I'm Rosemary Wally and I'm joined by Marlene Rattor in NDG and Laurie Yaris in Myland as I sit here on or in the plateau.
Thank you, Rosemary. We're going to start off with Marlene Rattor speaking about environmental issues and what a Canadian government should be looking at.
Dans cette campagne électorale fédérale, les différents chefs devaient pouvoir présenter aux électrices et électeurs un plan de réduction des impacts de la crise climatique qui inclurait la prévention de son aggravation. peu de temps avant le déclenchement de cette élection, le groupe intergouvernemental d'experts sur l'évolution du climat, le GIEC, a prévenu dans un rapport préliminaire choc que les pires effets des bouleversements climatiques se feront probablement sentir d'ici à peine quelques années si les pays ne prennent une action climatique forte à travers le monde. L'été 2021 nous donne un avant-goût de ce qui arrivera partout dans le monde, incluant le Canada, en termes de dérèglement du climat. On a eu des épisodes de chaleur plus élevés et sur des périodes plus longues que d'habitude. L'expression « dôme de chaleur » avec des températures frôlant les 50 degrés Celsius ne faisait pas partie de notre vocabulaire jusqu'à cet été. Sans parler des sécheresses, des feux de forêt et des inondations meurtrières un peu partout sur la planète dans des pays qu'on croyait à l'abri. La reprise économique post-Covid-19 qui s'amorce dans les pays développés ne semble pas en prendre en compte ces signaux menaçants d'un climat déréglé. Cette relance repose toujours sur la croissance de secteurs identifiés comme étant à la source des dérèglements actuels du climat, soit les secteurs pétroliers et gaziers qui favorisent les forages en milieu marin, la construction d'autoroutes pour servir l'étalement urbain. Or, le GIEC estime qu'il faut que les pays réduisent résolument les gaz à effet de serre et leur empreinte de carbone pour arriver à maintenir la température de la planète sous la barre de 2 degrés Celsius, tout en ne ménageant pas les efforts pour respecter le 1,5 degré de l'accord de Paris qu'ils ont signé. Il est d'ailleurs reconnu que les États dans leur ensemble ne pourront pas respecter les cibles de cet accord. Si les gouvernements de la planète envisagent d'amorcer la relance post-pandémique sur les mêmes bases qu'avant, on peut raisonnablement conclure qu'un désastre environnemental à grande échelle est prévisible. Malheureusement, un tel désastre viendrait annuler les effets escomptés de la relance, puisque celle-ci ne se sera pas adaptée aux enjeux climatiques de l'heure. Les électrices et électeurs canadiens sont en droit d'exiger des partis politiques la présentation détaillée de ce qu'ils comptent faire s'ils sont élus pour arrimer relance économique et protection de la planète et des êtres vivants qui l'habitent. Comment faire en sorte que les actions en faveur de la protection du climat soient prioritaires dans l'élaboration d'un plan de relance économique? Quelques suggestions aux politiciens en campagne électorale. Mettre un terme à l'expansion et au financement des carburants fossiles de façon à réduire les émissions de carbone en s'appuyant sur les avis des experts scientifiques. Prendre des mesures adéquates pour stopper les dommages causés à la nature, aux écosystèmes, à la biodiversité, etc. Faire en sorte que des investissements gouvernementaux soient capables de promouvoir des activités économiques qui assureront une transition juste et équitable afin de garantir une économie durable. Que le Canada respecte les traités internationaux qui promeuvent le respect des priorités des Premières Nations et la Déclaration de l'ONU sur les droits des peuples autochtones. Que le Canada investisse dans la planification de l'aménagement en créant des zones protégées pour les Premières Nations en respectant leurs savoirs ancestraux et leur capacité de conservation de la nature. Que la promesse du gouvernement sortant de planter des arbres en nombre important à travers le pays, à peine entamée, soit poursuivie quel que soit le parti qui prendra le pouvoir. Ce sont les principales actions, mais pas les seules, à mettre en œuvre par le prochain gouvernement.
Launched the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, issued a preliminary shocking report foreseeing that the worst effects of the climate change will probably start being felt in a few years if countries don't take strong action around the world to do something about it. This summer has given us a little foretaste of what can happen around the world, including Canada, in terms of the climate crisis. We had record heat waves, longer than usual. We've had heat domes with the temperatures going up to almost 50 degrees Celsius, and this was not heard of even a few years ago. And then, of course, we have droughts, we've got forest fires and floods, and a lot more severe and a lot more often than we used to get. The rebuilding of the post-COVID economy, which has begun in the developed world, the so-called developed world, doesn't seem to be taking these threatening signals of a climate gone mad into account. The economic recovery is still based on the growth of various sectors that are actually causing a lot of the climate crisis, specifically the oil and gas sector, which promotes undersea drilling for oil, construction of more highways to serve urban sprawl, and so on. So the IPCC feels that countries have to really resolutely reduce the production of greenhouse gases and reduce their carbon footprint in order to maintain the temperature of the planet under the 2 degrees Celsius mark, the increase in the temperature, I should say. It's already a foregone conclusion that most countries were not going to be able to respect the Paris Accord targets that had been set up when the agreement was signed. If governments around the world want to begin their economic post-pandemic economic recovery on the same basis as before, then it's reasonable to conclude that wide-ranging environmental disasters are going to occur. Unfortunately, disasters like this will simply cancel out the effects that people are counting on for an economic recovery, since we're not adapted to all these climactic changes that are going on currently. So Canadian electors are within their rights to demand that political parties present some kind of detailed platform regarding what they're going to do, if they're elected, to restart the economy and protect the planet and the people who live on it. So how can this be combined, economic recovery and protecting the planet? And Marlène has a few suggestions for all the politicians who are campaigning currently. So number one, to stop expanding and financing fossil fuels so we can reduce carbon emissions and base ourselves on the opinion of scientists. Number two, take adequate measures to stop the damage caused to nature, ecosystems, and biodiversity. Number three, to see that government investment is able to promote economic activities that will guarantee that we have a fair and equitable transition and guarantee a sustainable economy. And that Canada should respect, number four, Canada should respect international treaties that promote the respect of the priorities of First Nations and the UN Declaration on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples. Number five, Canada should invest in planning by creating protected zones for the First Nations, respecting their ancestral knowledge and their ability to conserve nature. And then lastly, but not least, that the government's promise regarding planting significant numbers of trees across the country, this has barely started, and this should be continued no matter which party takes power. So these are the main actions, but not the only ones, that need to be implemented by the next government that's going to be elected this coming September 20th.
Santa Maria, Santa Teresa, Santa Anna, Santa Susanna, Santa Cecilia, Santa Capilla, Santa Domenica, Mary Angelica, Frater Ashes, Frater Pietro, Julianus, Petronella, Santa, Santos, Mirasa, Padre, all the rest.
Okay, our next topic is foreign policy.
I've think it's really bizarre that we don't actually decide on the issues. It's the media that tells us what the issues are. And one of the things that everybody forgets or doesn't talk about, there's a taboo on discussing Canada's foreign policy, which is embarrassing, to say the least. So Canada is like a little toddler, a male toddler, that's following around a thuggy big brother, the US, you know, and just sort of in mindless admiration of this big brother. Now, why can't we end Canada's integration with the US war economy? Because that's what it is. And the war machine, with NATO very much part of it, we are spending a fortune on weapons. We're spending far more on weapons than on anything else, even though, as we know, Canadians need housing and healthcare and education, etc., etc. But our government really doesn't care about that. I'll give a couple of examples. One is, one thing that's terrible, and it really comes back to what Marlene's going to be talking about, which is the environment. Canada is heavily involved in mining. Not only are these mining companies Canadian, but the Canadian government is just helping them no end. So then this again is with our tax dollars. Canada's mining activity started really in the 90s, and the companies have expanded and expanded. It's what we call globalization. There's foreign direct investment coming from Canadian companies, and the government of Canada is opening up the economies, putting pressure on other governments and to join Canadian companies. Indigenous lands here in Canada and in places where we have mining companies like Guatemala and Haiti are considered to be zones of extraction for the wealthy. They're not considered to be nature or part of somebody else's homeland. They are zones of extraction. The Canadian government gives the green light for embassies to get involved, to support and encourage. They allow access to all kinds of capital. Canada puts in billions of our dollars into the Trade Commission Export Development, which is helping these companies. We even support, this is incredible, we support the Canadian mining companies when they get their blasting permits to blast local communities, for example, in Guatemala. I'm thinking of Hud Bay, which is a company. So we're helping to perpetuate violence and the displacement of communities. For years and years and years, people have been asking for an ombudsperson to work with the Canadian mining companies and the government of Canada. We now have an ombudsperson that's got no teeth, so nothing is going to change. So the issue of mining is but one example. There's a huge gap between the image of Canada and the reality. And this is not being given to the public, the voting public. Then another issue that's absolutely major and totally embarrassing is the issue of the Treaty for the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons that our country has not signed. This came into effect in January of this year and is the result of years and years of work by community groups across the world. Now, why haven't we signed? Because the US doesn't want us to sign, because they're a nuclear power. Now, we're supposed to not be a nuclear power.
Does Canada have nuclear weapons as well?
Canada does not now have nuclear weapons. They did in the 80s, but they don't now. No. But Canada's export of armaments, when you look at those pictures of the Taliban in Afghanistan, they're all standing there with huge guns. Now, where are those guns made? I can tell you they are not made in Afghanistan. They are made in the West. Now, they could be made in Canada because we don't know what is sent to the US. So they could be Canadian made and passed by the border where there are no conditions of any kind to the US government. We're not allowed to know which Canadian armaments go to the US. So they could be originally Canadian-made armaments via the US. That would be one possibility. Or they could be Canadian-made armaments via some of these shady governments like Saudi Arabia that we do business with. So we really don't know. We do know that lots of these weapons are used in a very, very shady way. We shouldn't be making weapons. But you see, it's very lucrative. It's something like, I don't know, billions of dollars every year in sales. And of course, you see, kind of the companies are encouraging, really encouraging conflict in the world because they want to sell their crop. So it's extremely lucrative.
Well, you know, it's always, that's always the ultimate goal, right? Money is what drives everything. It's always what drives everything.
But how come in this election cycle there is no mention of Canada's embarrassing foreign policy? I mean, we could talk about Haiti, Marlene. We could talk about the terrible policies that Canada has towards Haiti, the way in which it's armed different groups over the years, the way in which it's gone in there, you know, with we know best. And then, of course, there's a case of Venezuela where they've attempted to get rid of the elected government and support this Juan Guaido character, who has no legitimacy, of course. So Canada's foreign policy just follows the American foreign policy mindlessly, and this has got to end.
Yeah, it's like no matter which government gets in, which party gets elected, it's true, like Canada's image as being more reasonable and more just and kinder kind of country, I think that's being whittled away quite a bit.
It's still there in the minds of Canadians, though. They still think it's superior to the US and that we're basically a peaceful country and that our problems are sort of little problems at the moment, you know, like the pandemic or something. Not enough money maybe for healthcare, but we'll get to it. Yeah. This is not the case. That the corporations are stealing more and more and more of taxpayers' money.
Marlène, qu'est-ce que tu penses? Est-ce que tu connais un peu qu'est-ce qui arrive en Haïti? Est-ce que le gouvernement canadien fait quand même quelque chose d'utile là-bas?
Le gouvernement canadien a une politique étrangère qui est calquée sur celle des États-Unis.
Exactement.
Et présentement, on se battait, parce que c'est avant tout ce qui est arrivé dernièrement, on se battait pour que le gouvernement canadien, à l'intérieur du Core Group, le Core Group, c'est un groupe qui réunit la France, les États-Unis, quelques pays d'Amérique du Sud, et qui chapeaute tout ce qui se fait en Haïti. Et ce Core Group-là soutenait le président Jovenel Moïse qui a été assassiné. Mais le président ne faisait pas vraiment le travail. On a déjà parlé de ça la dernière fois, ce qu'il devait faire en tant que président. Mais là, avec la disparition de Jovenel Moïse, on voit que les pays qui sont supposés intervenir en Haïti se sont accordés pour mettre un premier ministre que Jovenel avait nommé juste avant sa mort. C'est une continuité dans le gouvernement qui existait. Et il demande des élections le plus rapidement possible. Dans l'état où se trouve le pays, il n'y a pas d'élection crédible qui peut avoir lieu. D'autant que par-dessus ça, on a eu le séisme dans la partie sud, un séisme aussi dévastateur que celui de 2010, et les conditions ne se prêtent vraiment pas. On n'est pas prêt, mais on parlait de faire des élections au mois de novembre. Alors, mais c'est eux qui décident. Mais c'est sûr que ce que la population, la société civile demande, là, c'est d'avoir une instance provisoire qui stabilise le pays avant de penser à faire des élections. C'est cette exportation de la démocratie occidentale qui nuit énormément au pays en voie de développement comme Haïti. Et le Canada participe activement dans cette exportation de démocratie. On l'a vu en Afghanistan. Ça n'a rien donné. Enfin, ça a donné quelque chose tant que le pays était occupé. Mais là, ils voient qu'ils sont partis, les pays occidentaux. Et il reste quoi? La terreur talibane.
Je pense que Marlène, tu as dit quelque chose de très important. I think it's very important, your last point, that Canada, like other Western countries, they're trying to export the Canadian form of democracy and impose it on various countries that didn't develop with those types of systems. And obviously, you know, it doesn't always fit exactly. And so you see what happens, like in places like Haiti or Afghanistan, becomes a miserable failure. And then it leaves a vacuum for more dictatorial elements, shall we say, to come in and to take over. And that's what's happening now in Afghanistan. And in Haiti, you've got basically gang rule, right? It's just gangs, armed gangs of people, armed gangs of men, I guess we should say, that are taking over. So, the answer is not just to impose.
Yeah, well, I'd just like to say, I mean, it's very interesting what Marlene says. It's very true. In Afghanistan, yes, they went in and they're coming out with nothing, but they're also coming out. Afghanistan has been totally destroyed. Thousands and thousands of people have been murdered and will continue to be with drone warfare that the Americans are planning. But the thing is that we're hearing none of this in the election coverage. There's no mention of any of these very important issues for which our money is being used.
Thank you.
That was Watan Jan by the Afghani Women's Orchestra Zohra. Even before the Taliban took over again recently, a lot of the women still had to be clandestine about their association with the orchestra, and they even lived in some safe houses in Kabul. And the piece that you heard was actually played on tour in Switzerland. I don't think they actually were able to play much in their own country. And of course, now music and women are basically forbidden. So I thought I would play that piece for you. I'm Laura Yaros. I'm one of your three co-hosts today. And to remind you, you're listening to Older Women Live on CKUT 90.3. And we're focusing on some issues that political parties and the future government after September 20th should focus on. We're going to go into public transportation now. Now, of course, due to COVID, ridership has declined and so has transit revenues. Just to give you an example, I have a government press release here from March 31st, so that was about 5 or 6 months ago, and operating revenues declined 72.7% over the past year or so since COVID, and of course so has ridership declined severely, but that's to be expected because we were all in lockdown and still, some of us still are and probably should be until we get this variant under control. Even before COVID, public transportation has been declining, both within our city and generally across the country. I mean, we know for a long time now the metro trains, for example, have been breaking down a lot, and service hasn't necessarily improved. But the big issue is that intercity transportation of all kinds has really declined. For example, bus routes have been abolished completely or cut down, and so have train routes. Tracks have been abandoned, and although in some cases local organizations purchased those sections of track and created short line railroads, but in the end a lot of those ended up not being able to make a go of it either. So this is trapping a lot of rural people who were relying on buses and trains in order to get from one place to another, especially if they had medical treatments or medical appointments. The frequency of transportation has also declined. I'd like to share a release from Transport Canada. This is part of a report from the Senate Committee of the Whole issued on April 29th of this year. So we're talking about 4 or 5 months ago. The intercity bus sector continues to face significant economic pressure due to the collapse of revenue resulting from a lack of ridership during the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. As a result, many intercity bus companies have suspended or reduced services, noting the financial unsustainability of operating in the current economic climate. Although, as I maintain, the decline in services was happening even before COVID. Several requests for sector-specific federal funding have been received, despite the availability of general emergency support measures from the Government of Canada, such as the CERB and business credit availability and so on. To date, several intercity bus operators have obtained financial support through federal programs. However, regional development agency officials have noted a hesitancy from some operators to take on additional debt, as a number of the programs offer loans rather than grants. On March 9th of this year, the government of British Columbia announced $10.7 million to support intercity bus services for 1 year. This allocation is separate from the funding that both the federal and provincial governments are jointly contributing to the BC Bus North service. However, the province has signaled its intention to continue funding this service into the next year. So transportation has become increasingly difficult even before COVID, as I mentioned about route cancellations and track abandonment and so on. We've also had in air traffic, we've had flight cancellations and airlines going under and people getting stranded at airports out of the country because the airline went under and so on. These things are happening all the time, so it's not just COVID that's the problem. So now travel takes a lot longer, where years ago, for example, you might want to go to a place near Toronto. Well, the part from Montreal to Toronto might not be too bad, but then to get from Toronto to another place would probably take you just as long or longer, because the frequency of buses and trains has decreased to such an extent that you end up waiting, just waiting in a train or a bus station to make your connection. So a trip that should take maybe 6 or 7 hours can sometimes take 12 or more. As Rosemary explains about getting to Kitchener from here.
What's really surprising is that my sister has lived in this area for 40 years, so I know the route quite well. The population in this area, which is not too far from Toronto, has at least doubled. And it used to be that there was a bus every hour on the hour until midnight from Toronto to Montreal, almost every hour on the hour. Maybe let's say there were 12 or 14 buses in a 24-hour period. Now there are four, even though the population has doubled. So people are forced into their cars, and they are forced to add to the greenhouse gases.
Yeah, you see, everything's connected, because exactly, people are not going to be motivated to travel 12 hours when they can get into their car, if they're lucky enough to have one, and get there in 6 or 7 hours, right? You know, why would anybody do that?
Je voulais dire que les gouvernements doivent donner l'exemple en offrant à la population des systèmes de déplacement adéquats qui favorisent la limitation. On ne doit pas prendre tout ce temps-là pour se rendre à un endroit qui pourrait se faire en moins de temps. L'amélioration des trains, autobus et tout ça. Mais aussi, il faut dire que si le gouvernement donne l'exemple, il se pourrait que bien des citoyens, parce que les citoyens aussi, on parle aujourd'hui d'une tendance forte pour les gros véhicules qui consomment énormément d'essence. Et ces véhicules-là, de plus en plus, c'est ça que les citoyens achètent. On n'achète plus les berlines. Alors, il y a aussi un effort à faire de la part des citoyens, mais c'est sûr que l'exemple doit venir d'en haut des gouvernements. Et quand on parle de véhicules électriques, il ne faut pas oublier non plus que les véhicules électriques fonctionnent à batterie. Et pour avoir les batteries, souvent, il y a des procédés qui amènent des dommages à l'environnement aussi, que ce soit avant pour l'extraction et que ce soit après pour la disposition de ces batteries-là. Alors, c'est très large comme idée, comme ce qu'il faut faire pour favoriser un meilleur encadrement de l'environnement qui s'emballe et d'avoir des solutions raisonnables et durables.
To briefly summarize what Marlène just said, the government needs to set an example for the public. They need to set up better systems and set an example for the public to be more aware of the consequences of different types of transportation. And the trouble is, and one big problem is that individuals are tending to buy bigger vehicles these days instead of buying smaller ones that are less gas guzzling. A lot of people are buying SUVs and other large types of vehicles, and this only contributes to the problem. And of course, with worsening public transport of all types, people are more inclined to want to drive their own vehicles than rely on public transportation system, and you can't totally blame them. But we also have to think about the consequences of the different types of transportation. Marlène was citing electric vehicles, and a lot of people are saying what a wonderful thing this is, and it can be a very good thing and produce less greenhouse gases. But we also have to bear in mind the means of production for the batteries for these vehicles, for example, just in terms of extracting the raw materials to produce the batteries. This gets back to mining industries and so on, which cause so much pollution. And then we have the problem of disposal of spent batteries once a car battery can no longer be used. How do you dispose of these things? Many people still just throw stuff away in the garbage and it ends up in landfills and it gets very toxic in those areas. So the government really needs to find ways to have reasonable and sustainable solutions for transportation. Well, this is all the time we have today for Older Women Live. I will remind you that you're listening to CKUT 90.3 FM. I'm your co-host today, Laura Yaris. Our other co-hosts today were Rosemary Wally and Marlene Rateau. I'd like to thank them both so much for all their contributions to this program. And special thanks also to Courtney Kirkby for all her technical help. Now, we've been focusing on what political parties should be thinking about and what a future government should be thinking about, but we have to elect this government. There is an election coming up on September 20th, so I'd like to urge all of you to get out there and vote. And there's many ways to do that. If you don't feel safe going in person, like me, for example, I know there's people and you don't know who's been vaccinated and who hasn't. You don't have to go in person on polling day. You can go to an advance poll, or you can get a special ballot and vote by mail. You can find a lot of information on the Elections Canada site. You can type in your address and get the name of your riding if you don't know it, and then you can look up your riding and find out who the candidates are for each party. You can also find the party platforms. Each party has their own website, and you can look up all the party platforms. You can also call your local riding association for the different parties if you want to speak to somebody about the issues. I'm sure that I'll be very delighted to talk to you and try and court you for your vote. So there's really many options that you have to find out information and to vote. So don't forget, this is really an important privilege and obligation that we all hold. And many people around the world don't have this privilege and sometimes even die for the right to vote. So please get out there and vote. We're going to go out now with a nice piece of music. This is Vivaldi's Autumn Movement from the Four Seasons, a beautiful suite of short concertos. This particular version is performed by the Netherlands Symphony Orchestra with violin soloist Frederike Seijgis. Be well and safe, everyone. Thank you.
la vaccination contre la COVID-19 se poursuit partout au Québec. L'effet combiné des deux doses assure une meilleure efficacité du vaccin, en plus de réduire le risque d'avoir et de transmettre le virus. Vous serez aussi protégé sur une plus longue période. Il est primordial de vous présenter à votre rendez-vous pour la deuxième dose du vaccin, peu importe ce qu'il y a d'autre à votre horaire. La deuxième dose du vaccin est essentielle. Un message du gouvernement du Québec.
Êtes-vous locataire à Montréal? Avez-vous des questions sur vos droits? Votre comité logement peut vous aider. Pour trouver le comité logement pour votre quartier ou pour plus de ressources, visitez le www.rclalq.qc.ca.
Gentlemen, friends, and comrades, to this edition of Amanda Radio here at CKUT 90.3 in Montreal. We're a weekly news show with the news, analysis, and briefings on the continent of Africa. This week we have a tremendous interview. Gwen got in touch with Andy Currier from the Oakland Institute, and they did a brilliant interview. The Oakland Institute is a think tank for progressives. It takes on land rights, equity, sustainable food systems, international aid, climate change, challenges the World Bank group and looks at food systems and so on. And they have done a report called The Looming Threat of Eviction, the Continued Displacement of the Maasai Under the Guise of Conservation in the Ngorongoro Conservation Area. And Andy Currier talks with Gwen about that. I've got a reading that I'm going to do from Canadian Dimension for the Canadian Foreign Policy Institute, which has put together a modest proposal for reimagining Canadian foreign policy that would bring Canada back into the modern world and take us out of the grips of profiteers in the business world. And finally, two short clips, one from Al Jazeera's Nicholas Hack about the coup that occurred in Guinea last week. And at the end of April, Hissène Habré died in prison, not lamented by very many people, serving time for crimes he committed against humanity, torture, brutal repression of his country in the 1980s. So that's a report from Deutsche Welle. Stay tuned to Amandla.